Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the program Dr. Antonia Ruppel with LMU Munich and Oxford University. Antonia, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Raj. It's so nice to be back.
It's nice to have you back. For those of you listening, today we're going to do something a little different. This podcast is formerly New Books in Hindu Studies, and it's becoming more broadly even developments or new developments in Hindu studies or study of Indian religion in general. And so that gives us a little more range of motion to investigate all that's going on. Having said that, Antonia's book that we covered, I believe last year, was a Sanskrit reader. It was the Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit. I believe it was 2017. And for a language that is 3,000 years old, 3 years is definitely a new book in that field, wouldn't you say? So we're just going to talk a little bit about Sanskrit, the nature of Sanskrit, the significance of Sanskrit, why one may want to learn it, what texts we have in it, and maybe talk about ways in which the listenership can go about learning Sanskrit. How does that sound?
Sounds great to me.
So obviously I know nothing about Sanskrit, so what is Sanskrit?
So Sanskrit is a language, mostly when we talk about Sanskrit, we mean two languages. First of all, what more strictly speaking is called Vedic, which is the language of the oldest scriptures that we find in the Indian subcontinent. And it was a language of religion, of ceremony, of philosophy, that then at some point was codified by a grammarian known by the name of Panini. This was around 2,500 years ago. And basically what he tried to do was to make sure that this language of these ancient but still fundamentally important religious ceremonial texts, he wanted to try and make sure that it remained understood. And so he was in a tradition of grammarians who tried to sum up who very successfully summed up the rules of this ancient language. But his grammar then had the effect that people didn't just see this list of rules as something that people had once followed a long time ago and that they needed to know about if they wanted to understand the ancient texts. But they used those rules from Panini's times on, basically, to compose Sanskrit texts of their own. So after Panini, we call this language Sanskrit proper. And Panini's work has had the effect that basically since around 2,500 years ago, people have used these rules to compose Sanskrit, to write Sanskrit. And so for 2,500 years, we've had texts following one set of rules, one grammar. And so if you learn Sanskrit, you can read texts from a period that spans more than 2 millennia. And it's a language that is used for literature, for epics, so for very long stories, for very short stories. You find drama, so you find plays in it. You find it used for all sorts of scientific non-fiction treatises. So you get law, you get mathematics, you get philosophy, you get treatises about how to act well, both in the private sphere and in the public sphere, so about good behavior and about politics. My nutshell basically is that there isn't really any literary genre that doesn't exist in Sanskrit.
And so for the last 25 centuries or so, has Sanskrit essentially functioned as a language for written texts?
In more recent times, yes. It's actually not entirely clear when writing first came to India, or when it first started being used in India, and also when it started being used for Sanskrit. Because the oldest traditions that we have, so the Vedic traditions, the Rig Veda, the oldest corpus of Sanskrit, of Vedic hymns, was a purely oral tradition for many, many centuries. And similarly with the epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, which are also two very well-known stories, those were also oral in origin. And at some point, in the past, I would say, you know, more past two millennia, writing then became a common medium for Sanskrit texts. But that doesn't mean that necessarily the Vedic and the epic traditions just switched to a written medium. There was a oral tradition that survived and flourished alongside the written tradition for a very long time.
So, be it written or oral, would you say Sanskrit is primarily for composition rather than conversation?
That is a tricky question. That's a very good question. Because so for people like me, who use Sanskrit mostly in a academic setting, for me, Sanskrit is like the other ancient languages that I know, like Latin or like ancient Greek, in that, yes, for me, it is a language that I mostly read. So I learned Sanskrit in order to be able to access these ancient texts and to be able to understand them directly without the sort of, immediacy of a translation. However, there is a very big spoken Sanskrit movement, and there are several things to be said for that. So, for example, if you are able to speak a language actively, then the kind of passive skills that you need in order to be able to read an ancient text are going to be much more solid, much more in place. So if I actually have had conversations in Sanskrit, if I actually have had to think about how do I say this, how do I phrase that, then it's easier for me to not just understand these ancient texts, but maybe also to see a few more nuances. However, having said that, and this is something that you find both for Sanskrit, and then you find a lot of, spoken Latin is a big movement, spoken ancient Greek, I think a little less so, but it exists. But there is this issue that the biggest spoken Sanskrit movements, to an extent, or to quite an extent, try to simplify the language so that it can be spoken in an everyday context. So when I talk to someone, when I order a pizza or a curry, then I'm probably just going to say something very simple, very straightforward, not ornate, not nicely intricately crafted, but rather I'm just going to say something straightforward and simple. And for this kind of purpose, so for this most purposes of spoken language, we need something quite different from the Sanskrit language that we find in the literature that has survived throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia. One of the reasons why it has survived is that people felt that these texts were worth preserving, not just for what they said, but also for the beauty of how they said it. So the oldest sources that we have are all quite intricately crafted and quite different from the spoken Sanskrit that you find very often nowadays. Having said that, there are quite a few speakers of spoken Sanskrit at this point who I think are fully able to speak in as ornate and as beautiful and as literary a way as many of the ancient authors were. but it's something where different people have different priorities. And I would say my priorities to this point are still the Sanskrit texts that I aim to read and understand.
So could you tell us a little bit about sort of the features of Sanskrit, maybe in relation to one who may wish to embark on a journey to learn it? So who might be well suited or not to go about learning Sanskrit, or might it be advantageous to have an Indian vernacular or not? Or, you know, without leading your question, can you say something about that?
Right. So first of all, you know, who is suited to learning Sanskrit? I think anyone, any human is suited to learn a language because, you know, all of us speak languages. Obviously there's a difference between the language that we learn just listening to our parents and our environment when we're little, and then languages that we learn in a sort of school or academic environment later on. But I would say that anyone can learn Sanskrit to some extent. And some will learn it, you know, further or more than others. There are plenty of people, especially in academia, but also in academia, whose Sanskrit is far better than mine. And still, I would say that, you know, I know Sanskrit to an extent that is good, is suitable for me. So I would say that, first of all, if you think you would like to learn a language, you would like to learn Sanskrit, but think that you know, you're never going to master it, don't worry. Mastery comes at many, many levels. And even if you learn it to the extent that you can read simple texts, there are many simple texts that are quite rewarding and just simply fun to read. Now, the question of what might help you learn Sanskrit, I would say that, yes, absolutely speaking, a modern, especially northern Indian language, definitely helps, because the northern Indian languages are languages such as Hindi, Bengali, Gujarati, and so on. They are related to Sanskrit. Obviously, if you know Hindi, then you already know the script that Sanskrit is typically written in these days, namely the Devanagari. So that's a definite advantage. Sometimes I find that knowing a modern Indian language can be a little bit of a disadvantage, actually, because quite a few words that you have, for example, in Hindi that were taken over from Sanskrit have changed their meaning. And so some words you'll basically have to learn a slightly different meaning. You'll have to relearn the meaning for what these words are doing or what they mean or how they're used in Sanskrit. So if you do not know any modern Indian languages, then that doesn't necessarily mean you have a huge disadvantage. I have had students who knew modern Indian languages. I have had students who knew other Indo-European languages such as Latin or Greek. I've had students who didn't know any foreign languages, so who spoke English, and that was it. And I find that if you do it the right way, if you do it step by step, if you don't try to hurry it too much, if you do it methodically, then basically anyone can learn Sanskrit. And
No, please go on.
The final part of your language, you know, who might profit from it? Well, in my opinion, pretty much everyone, as trite as that sounds, because there is just, and I'm happy to, you know, to stop here or to go into more detail, but I think there is just so much to be learned from a language that has such huge cultural implications and such huge cultural breadth, that there's basically something in it for everyone.
There's so many dimensions to this enterprise of learning Sanskrit. There's the dimension of access to worlds of thought and practice, content, narrative. There's this dimension of understanding language and grammar and syntax, and then there's the dimension of pedagogy, of, you know, how to go about learning it and tools. And so maybe let's talk a little bit more about the first dimension, because, you know, our listeners may or may not realize, I'm sure we have a wide array of keen undergrads, grad students, specialists, generalists, continuing studies folks, folks who have a natural interest in all things Indian, whether they're heritage learners or not. And so this language affords access to everything from profound philosophical musings of the Upanishads to liturgical texts, to Vedic hymns, to some of the most exquisite narrative on the planet, in the epics, Puranic narratives, to, as you say, treatises. Like one may go into a yoga studio and there will be an invocation to Patanjali in what? In Sanskrit.
Yes.
We all have this word karma.
Indeed.
It's good karma. and what is that? That is from an anglicization of an ancient Sanskrit word that is indispensable, inextricable from a sort of philosophical religious milieu. And so what drew you in? You know, what is it that drives or at least originally drove your pursuit of this language? Was it access to certain texts, a certain world? Was it just the intricacies of the language itself? You know, could you tell us more about that?
Mm. Well, my path into Sanskrit was a very, very fortunate slippery slope. So by training, I am a classicist, which means that as for my undergrad and also my other degrees, basically what I studied was Latin, ancient Greek, and the civilizations that they represent or that they give us access to. And I was particularly interested in the language side of things, so the philology or linguistic side of things. And in my very first term, we had a lecture where the word Sanskrit was mentioned. And so it was described as this language that was related to Latin and Greek. And so we there find these forms that are, you know, systematically similar to Latin and Greek and other related languages. And I had never heard of this language. I had never heard the word Sanskrit before. And I talked to some of my professors at the time and asked, you know, what is this Sanskrit thing and would it be useful to learn? And one of them then said, oh, Sanskrit is always useful, and gave me his spare copy of Michael Coulson's Teach Yourself Sanskrit.
And I can't help myself. I'll flesh it out later, but I have the exact same experience.
Really?
I showed up late second week of Intro Sanskrit 15 years ago. Gem of a teacher, Libby Mills at the University of Toronto. I think she's still there. I just can't shake the synchronicity, so I have to get this out so I can continue listening. I showed up. I abandoned my undergrad. I worked for a while. I came back. I thought, let me take three courses. I took three courses. I was happy with three courses. And then in week two, I thought, well, let me check out the Sanskrit course. I checked it out, and there were no books left at the library, and I was a week behind. I didn't know the script. And Libby Mills basically said, I wasn't even officially enrolled. She said, you know, you borrow my copy of the book and bring it back Monday. And that act of kindness
had succeeded. Far-reaching consequences.
It was like the divine intervened and said, "You pathetic chap that I don't know, who's a week late for a course and not even enrolled, who's just, you know, fumbling about here. You take my personal copy of the book." And I'm like, now Sanskrit owns me. Now I have no choice but to return. sorry to interrupt, but I couldn't shake the synchronicity.
This is wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that there's a parallel to this. And I suspect that there's actually quite a few people like you and me who sort of came to Sanskrit by chance, because so when I was in secondary school, you know, this was nothing that was ever mentioned. And I don't think that many people who come to university as freshmen know about it, at least, you know, definitely not in Germany where I went to school. I don't know about the UK where I went to university, but it's just not something that you encounter in school, and so you don't know that this is something that you might want to study in quite a bit of detail later on. But so I started out with Michael Coulson's Teach Yourself Sanskrit, and that book has many, many, many strengths, and it did wonders for me. It also has a few reasons for frustration inbuilt. But anyway, I think I did reasonably well working through this book. But I was still doing my undergrad in classics, and there was just a minimal Sanskrit element built in the third and final year of the bachelor, where we did a little bit of Vedic. But this was once again entirely from a linguistic point of view. Then I extended my studies a little bit, but mostly what I was doing was Vedic, because still this was from a linguistic point of view, and for linguists it's always the oldest levels of a language that are the most interesting. And so if you study Sanskrit from a linguistic point of view, mostly what you do is study Vedic. And so that's what I did for part of my master's, and then for my PhD I looked at a syntactic construction, an Indo-European syntactic construction that exists in several Indo-European languages, and it's probably most prominent in Latin, Greek, and Vedic, and later Sanskrit. So that's what I looked at. Those are the three languages that I looked at. And then I was nearing the end of, well, not the end of my PhD, but the end of my PhD funding. And so I was applying for jobs, and this wonderful post came up at Cornell University in the US, which was for a lecturer in Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit. And I applied, and I was invited for an interview. My parents said, oh, this is wonderful, you know, it's wonderful practice for you having an interview. Obviously, you're not going to get the job, but I mean, hey, this is great experience. I remember they basically said, you know, we are satisfied that you can teach Latin and Greek because there's plenty of evidence for that, but we'd like you to teach a Sanskrit lesson, because I'd never done that before. And so I prepared a lesson in great detail. And if you teach something for the first time, you probably over-prepare a little bit. And I remember running into someone in the classics faculty library relatively late at night, who saw me sort of poring over my notes and said, Antonia, what are you doing? And I told her, and I said, you know, I'm supposed to teach Sanskrit. And she said, Antonia, can you teach Sanskrit? And I said, well, I guess we'll find out. Then the wonderful, wonderful thing happened that I got the job, got the post. This was in 2005. And in the beginning, it was a very steep learning curve because I knew Sanskrit, but I'd never taught it. And the form of the language that I'd mostly worked on was Vedic. And the first course that I taught, or all the courses that I taught regularly, were introductions to classical Sanskrit. And so I was there always making sure. In the beginning, it really was a case of me always staying ahead a couple of steps of my students. I would like to think that it very quickly got better, that I really found my footing. But I, in the process of doing that, found that the teaching materials that I had available to teach Latin and Greek were great. I loved them. They were pedagogically great fun. The students liked them. They were suitable for the students, but I couldn't really find a Sanskrit textbook that I found worked for all of my students, who had a huge variety of background, much bigger variety than, for example, for classics. So I started preparing lots and lots of resources myself. And at some point, I talked to a friend of mine from Cambridge, who works for Cambridge University Press. And I told him sort of how things were, what was up. And he said, oh, you know, if you're making all these Sanskrit resources, a colleague of mine is interested in publishing a Sanskrit textbook. Should I put the two of you in touch? And so he did that. And then many years later, the result of this was the Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit. And basically the work on that book had the effect that I switched in my own private work and my writing and my research more and more from classics, from Latin and Greek, to Sanskrit. And so now I've reached a point where people ask me, well, you're sort of a bit of a classicist as well, aren't you? And I'm like, of course I'm a classicist. That's what all my degrees are in. You know, that's kind of still what I am. But actually, what I do these days, and perhaps what I'm known best for, is just sort of the Sanskrit side of me.
So many fascinating threads there. there's so much there. Let me keep it focused before we just fall off a cliff.
Sorry, that was a very long answer.
That was the past 20 years. That was great. No, what I mean to say is where to dive in. Let's keep it a little focused around the actual Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit the Reader. It's great that you, first of all, Michael Coulson is actually, that was my first Sanskrit text as well, and that's the one that Libby Mills had so generously loaned me that fateful weekend 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. But, of course, there were moments of frustration as well with that, and it seems that any Sanskrit text you'll use, there'll be pros and cons, also depending on learning styles and aptitudes and whatnot. But it's interesting that you built I love that this reader arose organically from your journey with your students, and it was a result of you learned Sanskrit, but you learned how to teach Sanskrit effectively based on the trial by fire, if you will. The Agni Pariksha.
Yes, indeed.
What is different about this reader? What are the advantages, or how is it laid out? Or maybe even say something about the fact that there's a website associated with it. Tell us about the reader.
Well, I think of it as a textbook rather than as a reader, because for me, a reader is something where you have mostly texts to read rather than, an introduction to the grammar. But that's just me being picky. Sorry. So basically, what I found I really liked about the other textbooks I was using was that there was a lot of there were a lot of texts to read. There were a lot of original Latin and Greek extracts that were prepared in such a way that a student who was at that point of their language learning career, so who were in chapter 5 of this book or chapter 7 of that book, so the texts were prepared in such a way that these students could read those texts with the annotations that were given to them. And I thought that was so important because, at least for those of us for whom the goal in learning an ancient language is to be able to read those texts, it's really, really frustrating if we, teach you the language and then for the first year or so keep you away from the actual language and just give you language exercises that were written specifically for your level by the author of the textbook. Because authors of textbooks may be good pedagogues, but they're rarely ever also good poets, for example. I definitely, unfortunately, am very much not a poet. And so one thing that I did was, from very, very early on in the book, I just put in as many readings as I could, so as many original Sanskrit passages as I could, simply because it kind of keeps your eye on the goal. You're constantly reminded of, this is what I'm trying to achieve, this is why I'm doing this, and also independently from that, simply because it's enjoyable. I mean, these texts, there is a reason why they were preserved over such a huge period of time. So that was one thing. And then the other thing I felt was, I come to Sanskrit from a comparative linguistic background. And so for me, it was always extremely helpful to be able to see what was new about the language that I was learning, but what I perhaps already did know from the languages I already spoke. So for example, if you learn Latin and you're a native speaker of German, German has 4 cases, Latin has 5. So the concept of a case is something that a German speaker would already understand. And then all I need to do as a Latin teacher in a German environment is just to tell people, right, and then there is another case, these are the cases you already know. Look, here's how you know them. And this is the way in which Latin is different. I tried to do this exact thing, but of course not for German speakers. The book isn't in German, it's in English. I tried to show English speakers what they already knew about language structures, how language expresses information, and showed them what they already knew, and then basically said, and you know, in here, in this area, this is where English and Sanskrit do the exact same thing, but note that in that area, other area, Sanskrit and English are different. So for example, an ending is a grammatical concept. It's basically the little thing at the end of a word that indicates who is doing something, for whom something is done, and so on. So for example, I would say, I go, you go, but he goes. So this ending, goes, indicates to me that I'm talking not about myself, I'm not addressing someone, but I'm talking about a third person, I'm talking about someone else. Now this ending is how English encodes this grammatical information. We're talking about a third person, we're talking about someone else. And Sanskrit does the exact same thing, except that Sanskrit has endings not just for the third person, but it also uses endings for the first person and for the second person. So it doesn't just have the equivalent of this S, but it also, when you say I go or you go, you would also add an ending. Now, you still need to memorize these endings, but the concept of what an ending is, look, you already know that from your own language. And so I tried to do that across the book to show people what they already knew, and to allow them to understand what was going on whenever that was possible, rather than simply to ask them to memorize something, because I personally find that with rote memorization, if I just memorize something, that knowledge I can find that it's lost at some point. Whereas if I understand something, even if I don't remember that particular detail, I'm still always able to reconstruct the information in my head because I understand the system that underlies a particular construction, a particular expression, and so on and so on. So I try to maximize understanding and thereby minimize the need for rote memorization.
So part of
those were basically the two main things that I try to do differently.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, I mean, part of it should go without saying that I personally feel the book is well set up. But also, let me indicate that
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's a service to our field. But also, I also should say that in my capacity as host for New Books in Hindu Studies, I take it as my role to invite new developments, new scholarship from credible presses, reputable presses, irrespective of my views. For example, I may be in my personal scholarship, and part of why I'm sharing this is not because of my exchange with Antonia, it's because of some emails I've gotten as of late, but I personally take issue with the study of Puranas and the ways in which historicism and philology has eclipsed looking at the literary narrative dimensions of the text. Having said that, I have fine folks on this podcast all the time who are gifted at looking historically material or philologically. And so irrespective of whether I have folks on the podcast, I may not agree with their findings or their methods or their politics, what have you, but that my role is to create a safe and inclusive space so that the general public and interested specialists and generalists can know and understand and value what we do in terms of producing knowledge about Indian religions. I just felt inspired to share that. Yeah, because it's not a question of factions for me. It's a question of let's have amicable conversation about what people are doing with these texts, these concepts. Having said that, I personally quite value this enterprise of this mission that resulted in the Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit, this text. Thank you for the correction, More Than Reader. It's definitely a text. If you go to www.cambridge-sanskrit.org, there is a wealth of resources that accompanies this text. So tell us about, there are videos there. There's all kinds of stuff there. This is much more than a text.
Well, basically, what I found over the course of the years is that there are so many people who want to learn Sanskrit, but who are not affiliated with a university or any kind of institution where they could study Sanskrit. Or, you know, many universities that people are affiliated with do not offer Sanskrit. And so what I wanted to do was basically recreate the sorts of things that my own students would get from me in the classroom as best I could, using online materials, using online resources. And so the videos, for example, they're very bare bones. They're just basically PowerPoint presentations that I've narrated and turned into videos and put up on YouTube. In those, I basically say the kind of thing that I would say if I was standing in front of you at the board in a classroom and was introducing you to new grammatical material. The difference, of course, is that, you know, you can never quite replace a classroom, and you cannot raise your hand and ask a question right away. But apart from that, those videos basically give you an electronic version of me as a teacher. I'm hoping that that's, you know, going to help some people with learning Sanskrit. And the videos are surprisingly popular. I mean, these are grammar videos in an ancient language, and we just hit 75,000 hits. So I must admit that I'm quite pleased by that. And yes, I am vain enough to be aware of this number.
you are savvy enough, shall we say.
Thank you. That's much nicer way of thinking of it.
Well, given that I study frame narratives professionally, I'm no stranger to reframing situations. But
well played. Yes, well done. So there are those videos. And then I find that another part of the whole learning process, especially with a language that has so many endings, as the things that I just mentioned, as Sanskrit, there's a lot of memorization involved, and I personally find that I memorize best from flashcards. I still have many little cardboard boxes with actual paper flashcards or sort of cardboard flashcards that I've made, but in the meantime, online flashcards have become a thing, or they have been a thing for quite a few years now. And so I basically just created flashcards for all the forms that you need to learn as part of the Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit, and then also of all the vocab. And then I put up a couple of just printable handouts. So for things where it's just very useful to have, for example, sheets where you can practice the writing, practice the Devanagari. Then I put up a simple reference grammar, also as just a printable PDF, because I find that when you're reading something, whether it's a practice passage in a book or you're reading an actual text, having something simple directly by your side on the table in front of you, where you can simply and quickly check a particular form, that's just very helpful, because it doesn't slow you down as much as it would to go to another book and find the right page or something. I made a couple of grammar posters that you can just put up on your wall. They're basically, you know, all the noun endings, all the verb forms, all the sandhi, which is something that is very prominent in Sanskrit, which is basically changes to words when they meet other words. My fourth poster is just for the script for the Devanagari. So I just put up all these things so that people who cannot attend a regular Sanskrit class can nevertheless have something that comes at least close to it. And then to sort of round that off, I've been offering free online classes, classes sort of in quotation marks, that you know anyone can sign up to. And the I say class in quotation marks because they don't actually involve any direct teaching with me. It's just that I basically set a pace and I send an email around once a week and say, I think for this week, a good chunk of material to look at is this. And here are the resources that I've put up online to cover this chunk of material. And, you know, if you've got questions, I've set up a Facebook group where anyone can ask their grammar questions and I or other group members can reply to them. So I try to recreate what a classroom offers as best I could using these online means.
Well, there's Sanskrit is, in my view, I don't think I'm particularly gifted at languages. Having said that, I do share your view that just about anybody who applies themselves can learn rudimentary Sanskrit at least. I mean, one doesn't need to rival Kalidasa in their mastery of the language.
Yes.
I myself use it primarily to read out of it for my work. I do have a fair bit of background in intoning and chanting in other circuits, but mm-hmm. I certainly wouldn't, I wouldn't be fluent enough to read Sanskrit the way I read a novel, for example. Nor is that how I use Sanskrit.
I know what you mean.
It's a very complicated language that requires a fair deal of support and expertise, and it's not insurmountable. In my view, it is the learning paradigm that obviously, you know, the desire, the will, has to be there for one to undertake something like learning a language. But provided the individual is intent on learning it, you know, if the seed is intent on sprouting, it's the soil that makes all of the difference. It's the instructor that circumstance sends you. It's the paradigm. It's the text. And there is no perfect Sanskrit text, obviously. And there is no replacement for sitting there having the expert attention of somebody, you know, parampara, from one to the other. The entire act of lineal learning is literally called in Sanskrit from one to the other, you know, and that cannot be replaced. Having said that, certainly there arises for anyone studying Sanskrit a wish list. Gee, I think of it as an app, right? I wish the app did this, and then there's an upgrade 2 months later, and the app does that now. I wish it did this. Wouldn't this be nice? And this is what excites me about the work that you're doing, because it's interesting to me as a Sanskritist, but it's for somebody who enjoys teaching and pedagogy and sort of catering to the needs of groups in different ways. This is what this is. It is a interactive wish list of how people might best learn Sanskrit. Something along those lines. Would that resonate with you?
Well, that is definitely the aim. You know, I'm not just a teacher, I'm also a learner of languages. So I basically went on the basis of what would I need, combined with what have I seen my students needing. So what have I seen has worked for my students? What have I seen, was formerly lacking in my own classes that I needed to provide for my students? What is maybe not absolutely necessary, but just makes it easier. I always believe in, you know, making certain things that can be easier and actually making them easier. And so that creating a complete learning environment that is complete, not just for one type of learner, but ideally for a couple of sort of learning types, that was the goal. And it would make me very happy to know that for at least for some people, they feel that I've reached or come close to that goal and have created an environment in which they are able to learn Sanskrit or feel that they have been able to learn Sanskrit to the level that they were hoping for.
Now, I believe I commented on this, or I certainly would have thought this when we spoke last, that between the text and the online resources, related to the text, including the video supplements, that this has all the makings, that the ingredients are in the kitchen to craft a fully developed online Sanskrit course. Now, it seems to me that I'm not the only one who saw the ingredients on the counter and decided to make that dish. Because, if I'm not mistaken, you are soon to be launching an online Sanskrit course. Is that the case?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. It was, as so many things in the world of Sanskrit, it was a, very fortuitous turn of events. I am on a mailing list on which the founder of a wonderful site and program called Yogic Studies also happened to be. So this founder is Seth Powell. And he read an email of mine, and he apparently had hoped that Yogic Studies at some point offer a sort of full Sanskrit course, and that whoever does it would use my book. And so he saw this email from me and said, why not just ask her whether she's interested. And indeed, she was interested. She was very interested. I was quite thrilled when he contacted me, because I think Yogic Studies is so well set up, using all the means that the internet gives us for long distance teaching in a way that isn't impersonal, that isn't sort of lacking the way in which a lot of non-in-person study is. And so we talked a couple of times, and we basically developed this course that is going to start on Monday. And so it will use
in the world of podcasts, they may not know which Monday you mean.
I am so sorry. This is Monday, the 1st of June, 2020.
Lovely.
Thank you. Yes. And this is the site is yogicstudies.com, yogic studies in one word. And you can find all the information about this particular course at yogicstudies.com/Sanskrit. And basically, there, of course, I am going to be using some of the same elements that I'm using in my free courses. However, the big difference is that for this Yogic Studies course, we have actual online teaching, two 90-minute sessions a week. So live teaching with me and everybody who's participating in the course. And also we have on the learning platform that they use, we basically have set up a forum just for the members of this course, where myself and our wonderful TA are together going to be replying to people's questions as they arise. So the one difference to a sort of in-person course is that people aren't sitting in the same physical classroom together, but we're going to be using Zoom. I hope I can sort of say that on here without it being product placement, but Zoom has these wonderful things called breakout rooms, where basically within a class, you can then allow people to just pair off in pairs or in small groups and do exercises together to discuss things and so on. So we are doing something that I think is as close to the actual classroom experience as it possibly could be. And that, both Seth and I have been using the internet for teaching, for long distance teaching, for quite a while. But now with Corona, lots of other people are realizing, what the strengths of online teaching are. And in these times when so many of us have to be either are under lockdown or have to be self-isolating, being able to offer a course that is so well, prepared and based on so many years of experience, I think is going to be something really useful and really valuable for quite a few people while they're waiting for things to get back to something more closely approaching the old normal.
Absolutely. There's so many parallels. I ended up defending in 2015. The following year, I was offered a your position. And for reasons other than the position was a good fit, but I just, the intuition just was insistent that I should stay put in Toronto. And then, you know, a couple of months later, the political landscape had shifted a great deal in 2016, as the world knows.
Yes.
And, you know, I didn't, when I get that intuitive sense, I have to ignore this brain of mine and just listen to it, because it often knows, right? So I thought, okay, well, I'll see what I can do to make a living here in Toronto and stay in Toronto. And continued my research relatively successfully. And it was a question of, well, how do I teach? How do I add value? How do I support myself? And I ended up creating this brand of online education parallel to yogic studies. It was called Power of Myth. It was more for the comparative mythology crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It was more for continuing studies students who are maybe more familiar with ancient Western traditions. I have since dissolved that because other projects kind of arose, but I really do think that there is certainly online teaching is the way of the future, and the future is already here, and coronavirus is facilitating the impetus of destiny to get us to do things from a distance. And so,
yes.
I at some point I have to chat with Seth about this really interesting plan he's developed, and I completely understand what he's doing. Like, I was kind of alone in the wilderness. It was so apurvata. It was so like unprecedented to be like, I'm thinking, what am I doing? I'm essentially funding my own research on a life consulting and online teaching career path. I'm like, what is this? What am I doing? And now coronavirus clinched it for me. I'm like, oh, this is what I'm doing. I'm just a little ahead of the curve. That's all.
I feel partly guilty that something that is causing so much, you know, so much pain, so much heartache, so much destruction is something that I am currently kind of profiting from. Yeah.
You are offering, it's not that you're going out and exploiting people offering some fake cure. Yeah. It's that people really need to find ways to feed themselves in these times, more than physically, I mean. And you're offering that. And irrespective of that, I had students in Europe, I had students in the States, I'm in Canada now, and coronavirus or not, I mean, we wouldn't have been able to have that experience if it wasn't for the online medium. And so there are going to be people who, you know, things might be, maybe in a year's time, who knows, things will be back to abnormal, whatever that is.
Whatever that is.
Nevertheless, some may be drawn to your text, and they may really want to study with you. And the only way they can do that is online, because they're certainly not going to hop on a plane, right?
Not for the foreseeable future. Yes. However, LMU, where I teach at the moment, is a lovely place, and I can only recommend it to anyone who has the possibility of going.
Coronavirus or not, I mean, folks won't have the bandwidth at the funds to go flying to cities just to take courses. So it really does open up the world. It really, really does. And I to be really honest, I was really prejudicial in 2015, 2016. I really felt that let me say a little bit of why. You know, I had the good fortune of being part of a lineage of experiencing Parampara and all of its glory. And so it etched in me this sort of this deeply entrenched, blazing experience of the height of pedagogical transformation. So I was like, you know, there's online courses. What can you get out of that? And then, you know, my eyes were opened. We had some very meaningful, profound experiences, classroom experiences online. All of my life consulting work now, even before coronavirus, is done online. Some people prefer the telephone, but usually it's on Zoom, so we can see each other face to face. And profound, intimate, transformative experiences with people with whom I've never been in the same city, you know, and that's mind-bending, you know, it's mind-bending.
I've had such close collaborations with people who I yet have to meet in person. And that is possible is wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. And in my current class, so for example, I'm still affiliated with Oxford, and I still have a 50% post there and a 50% post here in Munich, but I left Oxford to come to Munich to teach here. I can still participate in things in Oxford because everything has gone online. So I can listen to seminars because they're online. I can participate in departmental meetings because they're online. I think part of what we're learning at the moment is that for some things, online just is a very good replacement. But we're also learning that for some things, you really do need the face-to-face interaction. You need to basically be in the same room as people.
Absolutely. So back to the online course, basically, from what I understand, folks get live synchronous Zoom sessions, right? So some people build out asynchronous courses. In all of my teaching online, I always preferred the synchronous dimension, even if lectures had to be recorded for people who couldn't attend. That's something I want to highlight. So in the course that you're offering, it's not just the students or the learners digesting great content, which itself would be very useful, I imagine, but there'll be a live, immediate experience we're having now. Is that correct?
Exactly. It's two lessons a week, and they are at... Now I need to. I've got this in my Google Calendar, which means I don't have it in my brain. It's Mondays 5 to 7 GMT, and it is Wednesdays 7 to 9 GMT. And basically, we chose this slot because it means that we can cover a fairly large range of time zones. So people both from the continental US and also from Europe, and at least from the western parts of Asia can participate. It does unfortunately mean that for anyone in Australia, and we do have people participating from Australia, it means that if they want to participate live, it would be in the middle of the night. But the way we're doing it is that all the lessons are going to be recorded and are going to be made available within a couple of hours of them first happening, so that anyone can watch a lesson, whenever they want to. They can rewatch it as many times if anything is unclear. And I'm going to be using the lessons to answer people's questions and sort of just discuss and go over the things that people may have had issues with, or things that they're more interested in, want to know more about. And they can ask questions in the online forum. And then their questions will be discussed in the lessons, even if they cannot be there live for the lesson. So, just because you are down under, or you are in a time zone, or where you can't access the lesson easily, or for whatever reason you can't be there that day, your specific concerns, your specific questions, your specific interests will still be addressed. That's the idea behind it.
That's lovely. I might enroll.
I think it might be a little too basic for you, but there will be more courses to come.
I'll be really honest. This is I can't imagine how great it would have been to have this 15 years ago when I was starting. I don't begrudge it by any stretch of the imagination, nor certainly do I begrudge the experience of the students who will, as I say, if the seed is intent on sprouting, strikes me as fertile soil. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. And I have to say that so much of what I have done in my time as a Sanskrit teacher was based on sort of my own experiences and thinking about what would I have wanted at the point where you, my dear student, are now. What would I have wanted? What would I have needed? What was I maybe not really aware of needing? So with the benefit of hindsight, I basically just tried to create for them the environment that I didn't have, while at the same time trying to recreate the great things that I did have. I mean, I am where I am because throughout my life, I've just had really inspiring and really great teachers. I've never had any teacher training whatsoever. All that is good about my teaching is basically copying and pasting and combining ideas and input and inspiration that I've had since I, you know, first started going to first grade quite a long time ago.
Sure, but there's also the ability to copy and paste and integrate and reiterate. You know, when I first started in 2015, I'd never taken a business course. Really.
Right.
I'm a full-fledged entrepreneur now. Business was a dirty word to me. It really was. It really and truly was a dirty word to me. It's in my worldview and sort of my training and in my prejudices. But I've really come to see that what you talk about there in terms of, you know, providing the value to a group or person that you wish you had, right? Or you know that they would have it, that is the essence of the entrepreneurial spirit. That's what it's about. Whether that's for money or not for money, that's it right there. It's providing value to people. It's like, what kind of life consultant would I have wanted when I was, you know, at X age or X stage? What do I wish that person could have help me understand, or
exactly
for me. That's precisely what it is right there. It's that it's fundamentally a really sort of sophisticated form of empathy, which I really respect. Now, for the record, I this is not a paid advertisement. New Books Network hosts engage this work as a labor of love. And try to fit it in where they can in their schedules. This is my second conversation with Antonia Rupo, I assure you. And I have no dog in the game in terms of yogic studies. I'd be fascinated to learn more. You know, I wish them well. I think this is the way of the future. This is just me saying to my listeners that, hey, if you've always wanted to learn Sanskrit, if you're interested, if you have any intrigue in the Deva Bhasha and the language of the gods, for whether it's pronunciation, whether it's accessing, you know, systems of thought, whether it's just, you know, you'll read a passage from the Mahabharata in five different translations and they're giving you five completely different ideas and you're like, what do they mean? What is that noun they're translating? Oh, let me learn a little bit of Sanskrit. I can look at that noun and then have a much deeper sense of what they're trying to render into English. For any of you who have a remote interest in Sanskrit, why don't you check out this course? It starts Monday, June the 1st. You can go to, we gave you the URL earlier, but I'll give it to you now so that it's top of mind. It's yogicstudies.com/Sanskrit. We have been speaking with Dr. Antonia Rupel of LMU Munich. Oxford, now Yogic Studies, and the wonderful world of Sanskrit studies in the West. It has been a pleasure speaking with you today.
And with you. Thank you, Raj.
You're welcome. Until next time, stay safe, keep reading, keep listening, learn Sanskrit.